Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today, Tim, despite the fact that my voice sounds a bit like I swallowed the proverbial frog. There's warmer weather out there, so things are blooming and getting into my lungs. But you know what's blooming now, Tim? Your mood. I can tell your mood is blooming. How are you?
I am always happier in warmer weather, and that is definitely true now. Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. And I'm really excited to introduce this conversation with Kate Winkler Dawson, who is a fantastic journalist, author, and podcaster. She wrote a couple of great books called American Sherlock, All That's Wicked, and another one called Death in the Air.
And we know that listeners are going to really enjoy American Sherlock, the story of Oscar Heinrich. He was essentially the father of forensic science in America, and Kate does a masterful job capturing this man's life and telling his story. And she has a brand new audiobook that just came out called The Ghost Club, and it's a really fascinating, fun story, a true story about some of the world's most important thinkers and leaders, people who gathered once a month and discussed the supernatural at this thing that they called the Ghost Club in London. So we highly recommend that you check that out as well. It's funny because we end up talking more about this book than I think we all expected to. It's a really fun topic, really interesting historical topic. And Kate goes into the history of the Ghost Club, the fact that they're still around today. She actually visited the Ghost Club, and really a fun way to wrap up this episode.
And definitely check out her podcasts too. She's got Wicked Words and Tenfold More Wicked, so make sure you check that out. That's on the Exactly Right Network.
And you can check out everything about her at katewinklerdawson.com. And Tim, I've been hearing about this subscription service that we have for all of our shows. Where can someone go to access all of that content?
Yes, our dear listeners can check out Crawlspace Premium now on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe right there in the app. You get ad-free episodes, early releases, and our weekly bonus show, which everybody loves. And if you're not an Apple user, you can go to crawlspace.supportingcast.fm and sign up for the same product right there.
And Tim, you don't have to be an American Sherlock to figure out where we are at on social media. So tell me, is the game afoot?
Yes, it sure is. Folks can follow us on social media at Crawlspace Podcast or Crawlspace Pod. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We're going to break quick for commercial here, and we'll be right back with Kate Winkler Dawson.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
Kate Winkler Dawson, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How about you? Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. We're doing pretty well. This is going to be a great conversation because the work that you've done in your writing is excellent, and it does this wonderful marriage of history and true crime. You take the story of something seemingly unrelated and you bring them together like Eric Larson did in Devil in the White City. And Tim and I are both very much fans of that style. I didn't know I was going to be interested in this fog that hit London, you know, way, way back. But when you pair it with a serial killer, it's an incredible marriage. But anyway, thanks for joining us. Good work.
Thank you. My agent calls that pairing a little bit of medicine with a whole lot of honey. So you don't go in thinking you're learning about forensics, but you come out learning about forensics. So that's good. I'm glad that you mentioned that.
It is very interesting. You are quite prolific as a writer and a podcaster. And I know that you do the audiobook versions for at least some of your books.
Yeah.
Really well done too. So congrats on all this stuff. What do you like to do best? Write books or podcast?
You know, I like it all. I used to be in this mindset that I think a lot of people are who are journalists, which is, you know, you just be the best at one thing instead of jack of all trades. And I just decided several years ago that I want to be the best storyteller I can possibly be, that I don't need to be confined by one medium. You know, I don't only have to be an author or a documentary filmmaker or a podcaster, that as long as I know how to tell a good story, that I find all of these different stories, especially listeners will come to me with stories, and I can almost always find a place for them, you know, in the way that I tell stories. So it's very exciting. I like it all. That's the very long answer to saying, I don't know if I actually have a preference. They're so different. It's like, to me, the difference between, you know, California and New York, they're really different. I love them both.
Amazing to hear that you cannot constrain Kate Dawson.
Nope.
She's going to tell her story, whether you like it or not, but you will like it.
In every medium possible, yes.
Was there any doubt ever that you would narrate your own books? Did you want to do that?
You know, my first book, Death in the Air, that you had referred to, which was about a smog in 1952 that killed upwards of 12,000 people, and there's a serial killer caught in it along with a lot of other people. That book, I did not narrate. I had this incredible Scottish professional voiceover artist who has won many awards narrate that book. He did a fantastic job. When the second book came around, American Sherlock, I had started with this podcast stuff. And I went to my editor at Penguin Random House and said, I think I need to be the one who reads this, because even though the podcast had not yet come out, people would buy the books and still buy the book, thank goodness, would buy the book. They would expect me to be the one who's doing the voiceover. So that was nice that sort of pigeonholed her and she had to do it because it made sense. And so the first one, no, but everything else, yes. And it's always interesting to read the book that I've written aloud, because with Tenfold, I write it with an ear towards what I'm going to be saying. So I'll read the sentences aloud as I write them. They'll make sense and they're short and I don't lose my breath. But I seem to have amnesia when I write a full-length book, 90,000 words, and I always forget that I'm going to have to sit in an audio booth and say words like anonymity, and I struggle. So I wish I could get over that. My writing style changes depending on what the medium is.
Well, tell us about American Sherlock. That book and story is very interesting.
You know, the first book was a one big event, which was the smog, told through the lens of a lot of different people, various people who were in it, witnesses, people who struggled through it, somebody who died in it. And I knew the second book, I kind of wanted the reverse. I wanted one person with a lot of different cases to deal with. And I knew I wanted to talk about forensics. My father was a law professor at the University of Texas for many years, and he started the Innocence Project there. And so we always talked about forensics and bad science, good science. And so I wanted the second book to be a little bit more science heavy and to really talk about the tools that worked now and how they were innovated and the tools that don't work and how they were innovated. So I knew I wanted to find a forensic scientist. And luckily, I found Oscar Heinrich, who was known as America's Sherlock Holmes in the 1920s. And he solved more than 2,000 cases before he died in the 1950s. And he was amazing and just lost to history. And I had this incredible archive at UC Berkeley to use. And I, you know, picked 7 or 8 really good cases. And I was able to explore not only those cases, but the forensic tools he used, where we are now with those forensic tools, also kind of talk about his life, which is a very complicated life, and how he ended up doing what he was doing. It's a mystery. You have a lot of cases that you have to solve alongside him. He's an interesting man who's very tortured in his private life for a lot of different reasons. I think, you know, he has one really big case that hinges on him. And so I think it's interesting to see kind of at the end of the story how he lands on that case. The book is done very well. I'm always asked to talk about American Sherlock. People, I think, are fascinated with the Sherlock Holmes character, and women especially love a good mystery. So it's been great.
Yeah, it's a really eye-opening book because, like you said, he was sort of lost to history. Just operating in this true crime podcast space, I was really surprised to find out that I did not know about this person. And it was really refreshing to find out about somebody who is really instrumental in the stuff that you talk about.
When people say, how is he lost to history? I've never heard of him. And then I always challenge people and say, can you name one other forensic scientist in history? And most people could say Henry Lee from, you know, The Staircase or from O.J. Simpson. But these are people like Oscar Heinrich. These are people who worked behind the scenes. They were in the lab. He was on crime scenes, but that became unusual more in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. So he was this hybrid of a crime scene analyst and then somebody who was back in the lab. He always worked behind the scenes. His legacy was being a professor, which I teach at the University of Texas. So that really hits to have thousands of students walk through your doors and learn about the craft that you are so in love with. And that's what he did. So he doesn't have any razzle dazzle like Paul Kirk with the Sam Shepard case. You know, there are some pretty high profile people in forensics, but Oscar was an incredible professor and he taught people really the correct methodology behind collecting evidence and tricks and really some innovative things. And so I love his stories. I love telling his stories.
Yeah, I'm curious about what forensic tools he used back then. And I can't imagine they were all flawless.
No, they were not. He did some great things and he did some pretty bad things too. You know, when you have somebody who I read, Oscar, in 1 year was responsible for 6 different men going to the gallows. That's an incredible amount of responsibility. When I was reading through his letters, there are about 4,000 letters at UC Berkeley, and I read about half of them, which is a lot, 2,000 letters to go through. I never saw one iota of self-doubt, which I think is a problem. I think that he made mistakes. I think that there were people who were in prison wrongfully because this was the beginning of forensics in America in the 1920s. He was responsible for the first of many things. So the first forensic geology in the United States, where he used a grain of sand to connect a killer with a priest who had been murdered, and then later on to locate a body of a woman who had been dismembered. He used, you know, in that a new technique that people had never used before. He used bloodstain pattern analysis before anybody else did in a 1925 case. And he innovated a way to photograph bullets side by side through a new microscope called a dual microscope. And nobody had ever done it before. And he demoed it live during a criminal trial. These were all very new things. But at the same time, he was a big proponent of fingerprinting, which we now know, unless the sample that you get from the scene or from the gun or from whatever is really high quality, they are not reliable. He used a very unreliable sample in the Fatty Arbuckle case, who was the silent film star accused of manslaughter in the death of a woman who went to one of his parties. And Oscar used a bad sample, and it managed to hang the jury multiple times and destroy this man's career. It's interesting the roads you go down. I am not interested in the white knight. I am bored by the perfect person. So I'm always happy to find flaws. I have flaws. Everybody does. So I'm always happy to find that the sort of the flawed hero. They're the most interesting to me.
Did Heinrich intend to be this prolific forensic mind for law enforcement?
I think he liked a challenge. I think in a different world, he would have been happy being just a chemist. I think he fell into being someone who, you know, was involved in crime investigation and forensics, partially because of his father's death, which I go into in the book. He has to take a job at a pharmacy, which teaches him the very basics of forensics, which is toxicology, chemistry, and handwriting analysis, as well as some criminal profiling. Oscar was someone who I think had a really good basic set of skills in chemistry, a really solid background in science from UC Berkeley. I think he realized that the way where he had the most publicity, he could make the most money, he could get the most accolades, he was insecure, so he wanted accolades, would be to be involved with criminal investigations. I'm not sure he had this internal driving force towards, you know, achieving good for the justice system. I think he felt like he had a family to raise and he really needed to hustle and make money. I think that this fit in with a diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder, which I know he had. I had a friend of mine who said, do you think he became a little OCD? Did that trigger his OCD because he was a forensic scientist? And I said, no, I think he was a forensic scientist because he had OCD, because he needed that. He needed the perfection. He needed to record things over and over and over again. So it's interesting to look at somebody's character, and the arc of their life is almost as always, to me, interesting as the arc of the true crime story that you're reporting on.
I would like to ask you about your new season of your podcast, Tenfold More Wicked. The series on The Annihilator was fascinating. Eugene Burt. I thought it raised some really interesting questions about, I guess, murder and how Eugene was influenced.
That season was a difficult one for me. You know, I'm a mom. I have two 13-year-old kids, and I tend to shy away from stories about children who are murdered. There are cases where I look at them and say, this is a really interesting case that we should talk about. And I had never done a story on a family annihilator. That's sort of an old-fashioned term, but that's what they are. And the question behind Eugene Burt is, why did it happen? And certainly, what should be done with him? When it seems like this is someone who had some mental health struggles, when it seems like someone who witnessed something terrible in his youth, which was the result of a serial killer. He went to the crime scene and he found the weapon and he was briefly a suspect. What kind of impact does your environment have versus the impact that, you know, your inherent genetics offer you? What has the most responsibility and how much responsibility do you have? So this was a pretty extreme case. It was in Austin, Texas, where I'm from. And this is very different from what you're about to hear, which is, you know, season 8 of Tenfold is set in New Orleans in 1910. So, you know, get ready for trumpets and jazz music. I love music. My composer, Curtis Heath, is incredible. This is a different story. This is not somebody with an axe. This is someone with poison. The question that is raised that I think a lot of people are surprised as they move through the season is, was Annie Crawford a murderess, as they would, you know, refer to her in New Orleans in this time period? Or was she very unlucky because four members of her family end up dead in a very short period of time? And the question is, how do we know? Number one, you know, nobody believed a woman could have done this. And what would the motivations be? And then what do I discover at the end? And ultimately, what do I think happened? And I'm not going to tell you what I think happened. You have to wait till the end. But I have a pretty good feeling about what happened. So it's an interesting story. It's a very interesting story.
You touched upon what I think is that whole nature versus nurture thing. And I'm just wondering if you can elaborate on that a little bit more, because you also said that you like characters that aren't run of the mill. They're not vanilla. You like the anti-hero.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit just based on the characters that you've written about?
Yeah, I think it's complicated. People often ask me, do I believe that people are born evil? And I don't. I think people are born with problems. And I certainly think that there are people who are raised on to have problems. I think certainly you can come up with every single diagnosis in the world and you will find people who have not gone on to murder their families or murder strangers or murder other people. But I do think that there are circumstances that come up that make you say, okay, let's learn a little bit more about what happened here. I think Heinrich, with his diagnosis of OCD, was constantly trying to find an outlet for his anxiety, because that's what OCD is at its heart. It's anxiety. And he was, When I saw the journals, I knew exactly what it was. He had dozens and dozens of leather-bound journals that detailed every single penny that he spent, every little penny. He was trying to maintain control. So yeah, I think everybody has that capability. I was talking to a forensic psychiatrist and she said, you know, if my kids were threatened, would I kill? Absolutely. And I agree. I would too. I think everybody has the ability to kill. I think we all make decisions. And I think that our brains make those decisions more difficult for some people than others. And I think life circumstances make those decisions more difficult for others. But, you know, I was just talking the other day to someone about morals and ethics. And I brought up to a forensic psychologist about the morals and ethics. She mentioned the morals and ethics of serial killers and mass killers. And I said, morals and ethics? What are you talking about? They don't have morals and ethics. They wouldn't kill if they had morals and ethics. She said, you're wrong. They do. They are their own set of ethics, their own set of rules. They just don't fit our set of rules as a society. They're just their own. And I thought about it. And in that first book that we mentioned, Death in the Air, there's a serial killer. He killed a lot of people, women, and buried them all over the backyard in his house. But he would never, ever hurt animals. And in fact, when he went on the run, he had a little tiny bit of money. He used that money to take his old decrepit dog to the vet to put down. So that was his line. That was his rule. I am not going to hurt animals. I love animals. Does that make it okay what he did? No. But do we now see that there are people who have parameters in their own lives who still do terrible things? Yes. So that means to me, people are complicated, whether they're serial killers or Mother Teresa, people are complicated. There's no, to me, cut or dry. But I do think it's important to look at sort of the entire individual, their mental health, whether they have psychopathy, their history, their family history, you know, how they grew up, and then what their actions are later on.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
You mentioned the serial killer, John Christie. His upbringing was brutal, right?
Well, I think it depends. I would think it's brutal. He had a father who sounded very, very difficult. Speaking to people who are in London who grew up in the 30s and 40s, he sounded like a typical British father. Stern. And everybody's walking in single file through a field to get to church. And certainly, I'm sure, spanking. But there was no outstanding physical abuse that I heard. Very stern, though. The bigger issue with John Christie, who went on to kill at least 7 people, was he was incredibly emasculated by both the women in his life and then by girlfriends later on and by boys in general. He was sort of awkward. And I think that played into it a lot more than, you know, his father being sort of overbearing. I actually think his sisters and his mother were very, very overbearing. And I think that really affected him. Again, not an excuse. I mean, I don't think anybody would say that that's an excuse. But I think it does play into the idea that there are factors there that go on with people. And I think that we're interested in those factors. We want to know how people are raised. And the big mystery in true crime is, how could offender X commit crime X? How could this have happened? And how do we avoid being a victim of those people? And I think the answers are always complicated.
I love doing this because I learned something pretty much on every interview. And I just learned that just because somebody is a serial killer or was a serial killer and there's a history of his family being strict or overbearing, my brain just immediately goes to, like, he had a bad childhood.
Yeah.
That's the result. But when you put it into the perspective of, you spoke with people, and then when you read your book and you take it without that preconceived notion, it's like, okay, that probably wasn't that bad. But I'm just thinking about him being a serial killer and assuming that it was a lot worse than it probably was.
I don't know how bad it was. I know what he said, and I know what family members said, which was his father was very stern and probably pretty unpleasant. But we also know that there are people, unfortunately, who are horribly abused. They do not go on to kill at least seven women and bury them throughout their house and in their backyard. I don't think in any way can it be used as an excuse. I do think we are constantly looking for ways to figure this out. The people I interviewed were his contemporaries in age said, you know, I read what it was, and this is exactly like how my father was. Very stern, very strict, not very pleasant. But I had no desire to go and kill a bunch of people later on. There were obviously other things happening with John Christie.
Art, tell us about your new book, All That Is Wicked.
The book is about the criminal mind and exploring the criminal mind in the late 1800s, which was quite a trip. I mean, the ideas of what they had about why people commit crime in the 1800s were pretty unique. And it's about a man named Edward Ruloff, who people might have heard from the first season of Tenfold. He was a genius, both self-proclaimed and a, you know, proven genius in languages. And he was convinced that he had found the key to unlocking the origin of human language, which would have been a huge deal. It would have meant it's a pattern that you can teach a Frenchman how to speak Italian very shortly in time. And this would have been a $1 million idea in the 1800s. Ruloff also happened to be incredibly insecure, and he had psychopathy, I'm certain. And so do the psychologists and the psychiatrist I spoke with. He ended up killing, it looks like, about 4 members of his own family. And then he went on a robbery, and in a botched robbery, he killed a 5th person. And there are people who suspect that he killed more people. I think that's probably the end of it, frankly, for Edward Ruloff. But what's startling about this story is there is a moment when of a 6-month period when he has been convicted of murder and he's awaiting execution, but his lawyers are trying everything possible to get him out of it. And so he is shackled like Hannibal Lecter to the floor of this prison in this jail in upstate New York. And there is a group of men coming through who are trying to figure out through their own lens what makes this guy tick. So there's a journalist who Edward sees and realizes he's very religious. And so he tries to be very sincere when he responds to questions about religion. There's a journalist who's penning his biography who he confesses murder to. You know, there's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, there's a neurologist, a theologian. There are all these people. And with every encounter, Edward Ruloff manages to figure out what that person wants and fill in the gap, so that when they leave, they are utterly convinced that he is this person. He has this label. It could be monomania. It could be insanity. It could be sanity. It could be a million things, when now we know it was psychopathy. So you have all of these people desperately trying to figure out whether or not he should be executed, whether he should be sent to a mental health facility, or whether he should be released. And they have a lot of power. And he manages to manipulate almost everyone all the way up until the end. So it's fascinating to write about someone who has so much power, who people value because of his brain, more than the lives of 5 other people. Mark Twain, Horace Greeley, who was a politician, you know, the people who run the New York Tribune, a lot of people advocated to keep him alive because he was so smart. So that book really for me is, what do we value as a society? How do we see the criminal mind? And he became sort of the blueprint for criminal profiling. He was the first brain studied in the United States in a brain museum. And he was sort of the avatar for exploring the criminal mind.
And what did they find in the study of his brain?
The big difference in looking at his brain versus other brains was that his was very similar. He had a large brain, what is now considered in the top 2% of brains in the world. Structurally, with the exception of his size, structurally, it was incredibly similar, the fissures and the folds, to the brain of an incredibly like astute, respected white philosopher, of a black woman, of a person who had mental instability. When Burt Greenwalder, who was a neurologist at Cornell University at the time, when he looked at all of these brains, he said, everyone thinks our brains are different. The esteemed white men are going to have the biggest brains, the most unique brains, and they're not. You cannot say that a white person's brain is better structured than a black person's brain. You can't say they're better than women. You can't say they're better than a criminal like Edward Ruloff. And so he was one piece in the puzzle where you could lay out all these brains and say, men and women are created equal. It doesn't matter what their skin type is. It doesn't matter what they choose. There's no mark left behind on a criminal's brain. The common thought was this neurologist felt that when a criminal decides to do a crime, it leaves a mark on his brain that would be detectable after he dies and you dissect the brain. And that was not the case with Edward Ruloff. So he dispelled a lot of myths, which were racist and bigoted myths. And so he was this one, like Darwinian Finch. He was this one Finch that you really were able to look at and say, okay, this dispels a lot of myths that were very painful for people. So it was incredible. It was a great addition to the study of neurology in the early 1900s.
You are such a prolific writer. How long does it take you to write a book?
Boy, everybody asks me that, and I always have the same answer, which is I don't really know. So what happens is I have a lot of crossover. I will be in the middle of writing a book because I research and I write at the same time. I do a preliminary amount of research to do a book proposal. And then once we sold the book, then I'll start writing and I'll do research alongside writing. It's just the easiest way. Immersion is the easiest way for me. What happens, which is what's just happened for me, is I'll be halfway through the book and I'll start to get frustrated, or I'm so deep in the weeds that I need a break. And instead of doing what a normal person would do, which is like go to Disney World or watch a movie or do something, go mow the lawn, go somewhere different, you know, instead I look for the next book. So then I look for the next book and I go down a rabbit hole when I find that book, and I talk to my agent and she says, I love it. And I talk to my editor and she says, I love it. And I put together a portfolio while I'm writing the other book. So they all really mesh together. And now when you throw in three podcasts, and I have an audiobook coming out, exclusive audiobook coming out in a few weeks. When you add all of those in, I'm just sort of constantly writing, and sometimes writing big projects one day next to the next. So they all mesh together. So it's a complicated, I would say 2 to 3 years, but I can't give you a definite. There are a lot of people who could say, oh yeah, I started May 1st and ended October of, you know, 2023. And that's not the case for me, unfortunately.
I think you use the word immersion, and you're researching another book, and it's maybe a bit of a clunky segue to my next question, but I'll make it work on some level. Does it ever make you nervous as you're researching and exploring the minds of these individuals, these dark, brilliant minds, that somebody like Edward Ruloff might get inside of your head and you might start thinking a little bit too much like that person?
No, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. And maybe if I were younger, I would be, you know, more fascinated with the mind and how influential it could be on other people, including me. But I'm pretty sure of who I am at 48. So I am able to look at these people, realize they're real, but they are also, for me, they're characters that I'm helping craft. It's just like any author, you take research and you pick and choose what you use, and you craft sentences that take out information that you feel like might be offensive or is too much information, and you leave in what is appropriate. So pretty sure of who I am at this point. So I don't worry about it. That doesn't mean I'm not disturbed by some of the stories, though, for sure. I mean, there are some stories where I just go, this is terrible. And I have to make decisions about how much time I want to spend on those stories.
Yeah, because I can imagine exploring all of these historic crimes. There's a number of crimes that must be just like unspeakable.
Yeah, and I generally don't do those, to be honest. I mean, I have a really hard time with sexual assaults, and I don't have cases that I don't write books that are heavily involved with sexual assault. It just bothers me. John Reginald Christie was an exception. And I worked really hard to have the impact of the assaults there, certainly, but not add things that I felt like were exploitative of what happened. And I think that that does come up in some true crime content, is, you know, you're adding details that are unnecessary. So I really work hard to not do that. I'm blessed because I can be picky about what I do. The books that I pitch, the podcasts that I do, I'm in total control of all of it. Karen and Georgia at Exactly Right are not telling me, you have to do this story. I pick the stories, including Buried Bones. I pick the stories. I choose the authors I interview. You know, I pick the books that I write. And people either want to buy them or they don't. So I'm lucky that that happens.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
Okay, well, tell us about your new book that is coming out very soon, The Ghost Club. Lance has already warned me. He told me not to ask about this because he was very scared about this.
You should be scared, Lance.
I'm going to have to leave.
I love this book, man. I mean, this is not a printed book. People ask me, oh, is it a printed? No, it would be a large pamphlet if it were printed. It's a 30,000 word, which is a pretty long 4 to 5 to 6 hour audiobook. It is set in London and it spans from the late 1800s into the, 1930s. And it's about a group of men. It was an exclusive all-men's club, started with Charles Dickens in London. They would eat French food and wear suits and talk about politics. They would talk about their personal lives, but mostly they would talk about real-life ghostly encounters. There were certain time periods where they investigated these ghostly encounters, and Dickens did too. This is a club that's still in existence, the oldest ghost club in the world. Eventually, you would have some incredible members join. You would have Arthur Conan Doyle. You would have Harry Houdini. You would have William Yeats. And then a man named Harry Price, who was the world's most well-known ghost hunter. And he became the chairman of the Ghost Club. And Harry Price investigated all sorts of, paranormal activity, including England's most haunted house, which was called the Borley Rectory in a small, town called Borley Village. Harry Price buys the house for a year and moves in and investigates what happens at this house, because we are talking about more than 100 years of nuns, floating around the yard, being assaulted by different ghosts, plates crashing, notes flying, almost like a hurricane of notes coming down from the ceiling. So either we're talking about a couple hundred years of people screwing with the people who lived in the Borley Rectory, or there were ghosts. And so the Ghost Club hears all about this, and at the same time, they conduct their own investigations. And so the question for me is, this is about spiritualism, which was a very big movement after the Civil War and during World War I and after, because you have all of these men ripped away from their families. And these are people who just want one more chance to say goodbye to their husband or, their son or their brother. And you have all of these fraudulent mediums who are there to take their money. And so the Ghost Club's edict was to investigate that. But there were so many scary things. When you read about colonels in the British Army retelling stories from their childhood, like there was one man who said, when I was a boy, I was at a drawing table and I was drawing something and, my cat was laying nearby and I got up to go get a glass of water and I came back and the cat was exactly where it was, but there was blood all over the drawing table, dripping down like a flood of blood that had come down. And then there was another man who stood up in that same meeting and said, well, I have a letter to read. And it's about a man who tells his young daughter, who's 7 or 8, I have to go on a trip. And she says, I don't think you should go, Daddy, you're going to die. And he says, no, I won't. I'm going to go. And he goes and he gets on the Titanic and he dies. I know, Tim, the look on your face.
Tim loves the Titanic.
These kinds of stories. And we are talking about highly educated, incredibly powerful politicians, Maharajis, just like these people who you would look at and say, there's no way they'll believe in ghosts and goblins and fairies. And there were all kinds of stories like that. So the question for me is this a conspiracy of hundreds of thousands of people over a 20 or 30 year period who all believe in this or don't believe in it and are trying to gaslight the rest of the world? Or was there paranormal activity and is there now? And how do you know? How do you know who to believe? What medium should take your money because they can connect you with Aunt Edith? I love that book, boy, because I love a good ghost story. I really do. I grew up in a haunted farmhouse in Texas, so I love it.
Did I mishear you? Did you say that this club still exists?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I went to the meeting last year. I've gone to a couple
of
them.
Who's in it?
Well, I mean, just a variety of mostly true believers, I would say. And they meet once a month, just like the old Ghost Club did. When I went, there was a man who was a professor of parapsychology at Oxford University. I think that's the right title. And he was a magician. And he showed us the way that people in this time period in the 1920s, how they would get away with like slate writing. Slates would be, you would put two kind of small chalkboards together, could come up with a drawing with these two chalkboards in between or writing. And it was apparently a spirit who was doing it. And he would show us how the mediums would do it. And he talked about in the 1920s, the mediums would actually have blue books. So if Lance is a medium and we know, Lance and I know that Tim is going to go visit him, and Tim has visited me, and I know that Tim's younger brother had died when he was younger, I would sell that story to Lance. Because I would tell Tim, oh, you want some real detail? Go to Lance. Lance will give you all the information. I would write up everything I possibly could in a blue book and sell the information to Lance. And the professor said that people do that now, except they use social media for their research. So they'll ask for your name and information beforehand, and they'll do loads of research on Facebook or Twitter or whatever.
So you're saying in so many words that Mark Zuckerberg is a member of the club.
In a way, I suppose. I suppose. Yeah, boy, it's really, you know, and I'm not saying, before I get hate mail, I'm not saying that there aren't authentic mediums. I don't know. I've never gone to a medium. I'm sure there are. But I'm telling you that I'm writing about a mix of authentic and inauthentic mediums in London during this time period. There was so much money that people would be willing to spend just to talk to their loved one more time. Just one more time. And I can see that vulnerability. You know, I understand that vulnerability.
I think one might counter that by saying, hey, if somebody wants to give another person their money and they truly believe it and it makes them feel better, then what's the harm?
I guess it depends on the information that you're looking for. Like some
That's
people
true.
Would ask for guidance. Aunt Edna, should I marry Tim? What do you think? What do you think about him? It's like if you're the medium, you're going, what do I think of Tim? I don't know.
I think he's a swell guy.
I think it depends. You think he's a swell guy. I like that guy. I mean, I think it depends, really. I know what you're saying. I kind of go back and forth. I think if you go through it thinking this is entertainment, that there are people who use Miss Cleo as a way to guide their lives. I don't know if you'll remember Miss Cleo from the old
don't
commercials.
Don't you dare besmirch the name of Miss Cleo. I see where you're going with this.
She was my favorite.
There's a documentary about her. I haven't seen it yet, but there's a whole documentary about Miss Cleo. But there are people who spend so much money with the assumption that they would be guided by a medium. You know, as much as I would like to think that there are mediums who are all authentic and want your best interest at hearts, there's not. It's hard to know. I think somebody asked the professor at the Ghost Club, how can you sort out who the good mediums are? And he said, it's really hard. You have to be tricky. You know, you have to like kind of catch them in something. It cannot be generic. Oh, I see you being married to a man in a blue zip up with kind of a beard. You know, you need more details than that.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, no, who is that? Oh, that's Tim. That's what the guy will say. You should marry Tim. It is really tricky. And I am certainly at my heart, I am a skeptic. But I grew up, and I explained this at the beginning of the Ghost Club, I grew up in a farmhouse in Texas that was built in 1895. And the last person who lived there beside my family was the county's first coroner. Undertaker's probably more accurate. So there were hundreds of bodies who went through this house. As skeptical as I am not convinced that there is not something going on with that house. I just don't think you can have that many bodies and not leave behind something. My co-host Paul Holes of Buried Bones would say, oh, they left behind stuff. I'm sure if we did all kinds of DNA tests on that floor, you would find all kinds of fluid. But I mean spirits. I'm not convinced that there's not something in that house because there's just so many people whose bodies went through there. So I go in sort of with open eyes into this story, but it's so odd to hear these incredibly powerful men who are just saying, I remember, you know, my dead uncle was playing piano during my mom's wedding. And I was thinking, what? They sound silly. So are they gaslighting everybody else? Is this some sort of a community, you know, like a connection that they're looking for? I don't know. It's a lot of people convinced of ghosts, though, during this time period. Do you two believe in ghosts?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to ask you a little again. You know, I know you kind of said you're a skeptic, but I'm wondering how you could tell the real mediums from the fake mediums And then you grew up on this house, you know, this haunted house. I feel like you're truly a believer, but you feel like you have to say you're a skeptic.
I think it's a little of both. I go back and forth, which is what I think my good journalist does. You sort of go, I can be convinced one way or the other. I mean, I'm supposed to be trained to look at all different sides of a story. I could see all different sides of the story, but boy, I'm pretty grounded in science and in, you know, I need to see it to believe it. And you have to have blind faith with this. And hearing all of those stories, like, could they all be making this up? I mean, I read probably 1,500 stories of various ghosts and spirits and objects moving out of the middle of nowhere and, right, predicting the Titanic, people who are tied up inside of a cabinet playing music. I mean, there's just so many different explanations for what was happening. And I can't believe that many people would lie. Some of the stories were, one of them was Arthur Conan Doyle was at a seance, and he was contacted by the editor, who had been dead for 150 years or something, of the Times of London. And he asked questions like, oh, are there newspapers available in the afterlife? And I thought, who the hell cares? Why are you asking that? And it's because it's indisputable. I mean, how are you going to prove it otherwise? He did not ask anything concrete. Like, let's prove that you somehow, I don't know what question that would be, but you know, there were people who were true believers who didn't want to ask questions of the medium that were going to challenge the medium necessarily. And that's where Harry Price was really interesting. His job was to challenge everybody and to figure out who was fake and who wasn't. I actually think the medium was Doyle's wife. In that one, Gene, I think in that one, they're just, it's odd. There was another tale of someone who was an amateur cricket player, and he had a really tough shot, you know, the game of cricket. He had a really tough shot. He couldn't figure it out. But then he heard from his friend, who was a professional cricket player who had been dead for quite some time. The dead friend said, let me help you. Let me guide you. I'll tell you where to go. And I just thought, what an odd ghost story. I don't know. It's just, you know, I mean, and those are, it's mundane and stupid, but that sort of interaction lent to the authenticity of those stories, because it was a wide array. It wasn't all like, you know, Scooby-Doo Adventures kind of stuff. It was really small things of just people reaching out. Like, there was an investigation where one of the members of the ghost club is sitting with the medium, and she is the conduit for his child who had died. I think he was 10 or 11. The ghost club member was unconvinced that this was his kid. The woman starts sort of trying to mimic what the boy would have sounded like. And I just think that the ghost club member almost punched her, because he just said, this is BS. I mean, there's no way. Boy, she tried really hard, though. She was offering him things like, we were at this museum one time. Well, yeah, there was a shelf in the museum. Okay. There was a rock in the museum on display. Okay. I mean, you know, these are these things that would have been present no matter what. Their investigations turned up a lot of false mediums, which was really interesting, but they were mostly true believers. There were not a lot of skeptics. What they believed was, there are real mediums, but there aren't very many of them. But when you find them, they're worth the money. We need to elevate them, and we need to expose the bad ones, because they're ripping people off. So there you go.
I thought you were going to say that the cricket player's friend said, I have the answer for you. Quit cricket, because it's a terrible game.
I'm not going to. No comment.
Shots fired. I'm not going to
piss off any of your listeners.
We just got canceled by the cricket community. Sorry. What a great conversation.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun. We really appreciate it.
Well, keep under the covers and keep wary of ghosts and goblins around you. They're there. I'm convinced now they're there.
You keep typing those books, and we'll keep reading them and having you on to talk about them. We'll highly recommend them to all the listeners. So, well done.
Great. Thanks, guys.